Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live on this holiday Sunday, April 16th, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a guest returning to the air who hasn't been with us for a couple of years, but someone who was much appreciated when here 2 years ago and has been requested heavily since then. One of the real giant figures in understanding, making sense of the internet and the key issues surrounding the internet will determine what role digital communication will play into our future. Our guest today on Media Matters is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford Law School, coming to us live from the West Coast. But first, before we go to Larry Lessig, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The House of Representatives looks ready to give cable and phone companies the power to kill off the internet as we know it in exchange for a pay-as-you-go style online experience. The House Telecommunications and Internet Subcommittee voted just prior to the Easter recess on a bill that directs the FCC to issue fines of up to $500,000 against any internet service provider who is caught practicing data discrimination, but the bill does not grant the FCC the authority to define just what that discrimination might be. Subcommittee member Representative Rick Boucher of Virginia says the provision does nothing to preserve the principle of network neutrality.
The FCC, under current law, is kind of powerless to act unless it can persuade the bad actor to adopt a different course.
Debate on this issue in the House is certainly not over, but it appears that telecom lobbyists are making moves to squelch it. The House's Judiciary Committee was to hold a hearing over the break on antitrust concerns in the telecommunications industries and how network neutrality fits into that picture, but that's been postponed indefinitely, no reason given. Boucher says the prospect of preserving net neutrality as a point of law in the House looks pretty bleak.
By the middle of May, in all likelihood, this measure will have been debated and passed in the House.
In hopes of maintaining their momentum, telecom interests led by AT&T have started up a new AstroTurf group named Hands Off the Internet that purports to represent, quote, a nationwide coalition of internet users, end quote, who oppose network neutrality. It's hired former Clinton press secretary Mike McCurry to be its public face. Boucher says this may be the only chance we've got to preserve an open and democratic internet where anyone can speak freely to anyone else, and the House has already blown it.
Once revenue is being derived by a business from a particular business model, it is virtually impossible to outlaw the business model. If telephone companies 5 years from now are deriving billions of dollars in revenues from this toll gate apparatus they've put in place, and we see that innovation is dampened and we can measure that effect, it's going to be too late to act.
Two bills pending in the Senate explicitly address network neutrality as a matter of policy, but there's no guarantee that the principle would survive the conference committee experience.
The pressure against America Online's plans to roll out a pay-to-send email service is on the rise. At a conference last month, supporters and opponents of AOL's so-called certified email system squared off in a panel discussion. Richard Gingras, CEO of Goodmail, the company AOL has contracted with to provide the pay-to-send technology, says he's got a lot riding on this deal.
There's a tremendous amount of effort and capital and technology that goes into creating what we're creating. We've been doing this for 2.5 years. I've raised and spent at this point well in excess of $10 million developing the company.
According to AOL Postmaster Charles Stiles, the paymail plan is designed as a weapon to reduce the amount of spam and fraudulent phishing messages sent to its 20 million users.
We have to protect our customers from phishing. They've told us over and over they need some protection.
The anti-spam angle is also a strong selling point for Goodmail, according to the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Danny O'Brien, who's helping to lead a campaign against email postage.
This is something from Goodmail's own FAQ. GoodMail gives to mailbox providers the possibility to profit from the opportunity to address the economic imbalance, now borne exclusively by mailbox providers, in the fight against spam and fraud.
Concerns about the certified email project spurred California State Senator Dean Flores to hold hearings on the issue earlier this month. GoodMail's Richard Gingras was there, and under questioning by Flores, he inadvertently debunked AOL's primary stated reasons for implementing paymail.
Our objective, again, is to address how can we create a mechanism to assure that the messages that come via our system are indeed authentic.
And you believe that's going to lead to a significant reduction of spam?
No, we've never said that. We do not have any impact on what the bad guys in Ecuador or Belarus or Des Moines, Iowa, do in sending bad messages in the system.
A coalition opposing what it calls an AOL-imposed email tax, which launched in February with some 50 member groups, is now more than 600 strong. An open letter to AOL explaining their concerns has attracted more than 41,000 signatures. You can find out more about this controversy by visiting DearAOL.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you here on WILL AM 580, Sunday, 16th of April, 2006. A live show for you on this holiday weekend, and we're very privileged to have a guest we like to have on the show. We've had in the past, and it's been much anticipated by many of our listeners. Our guest today is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law at Stanford Law School and founder of that school's Center for Internet and Society. Professor Lessig is the author of numerous books, all of which I've used in my classes. Most recently, Free Culture, 2004, The Future of Ideas, 2001. And then the first book he wrote that drew my attention, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, 1999. Larry Lessig chairs the Creative Commons Project, and he serves on the board of a number of important organizations, including Free Software Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Public Knowledge, and recently joined the board of Free Press, the group I fortunately have a hand in as president. So, Larry Lessig, thank you for joining us today, Media Matters.
Thanks for having me.
That's really a delight. Larry, you're well known to many of our listeners, but a lot of our listeners are not necessarily up to speed on internet, may not be that familiar with you or your work, and some of them aren't even that familiar with the internet. And I was wondering, I was going through your books just a few days ago preparing for the show, and you've been writing, I don't know, for a decade, I'd say at least, on internet issues, constitutional law, policy, issues about technology. Just standing back for a second, what do you think, what's happened in the last decade that has most surprised you with regard to the internet and technology? And what most concerns you in the last decade that didn't concern you 10 years ago when you started writing about it?
Well, I think the thing that surprises me most is that people still don't recognize the particular way in which technology can either support or undermine important values that we might have. And so because they don't recognize that the relationship between technology and values, they don't think about ways in which we should make sure that the technology reflects the values that are important to us and ways in which we should avoid allowing technology interfere with those values. So, for example, in the context of copyright is a very important legal protection for the creative process. But it's always been balanced in our tradition by, for example, limitations like fair use. Well, fair use is a legal limit on the scope of the copyright protection. But when technology begins to protect copyrighted material, for example, digital rights management technology, which gives the copyright owner the power to control how people use copyrighted material, then the digital rights management technology may or may not respect things like fair use. So here technology is displacing an important public value, namely fair use, and it should be, it seemed to me, it should have been obvious that we have a reason to be concerned about that sort of technology and maybe even legislate to avoid the limitations on principles like fair use. Yet whenever I testify about these issues before Congress, there's a complete lack of awareness, totally oblivious to the ways in which these important public values get eroded by this technology. And I understand how that would have been the view 10 years ago, but it's getting a little bit depressing to see that that continues to be the kind of ignorant approach that at least most policymakers bring to this question.
In fact, I think that was sort of the dramatic argument of your first book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, of the importance of the way that the code that is written for the Internet, for the applications on the Internet, sort of point us in certain directions that have the same effect as a law or a market power.
Exactly right. It's a kind of regulator. And obviously, it's not the same as a law, or it's not the same as market power, or not the same as social norms. But it's extremely important. And in cyberspace, I think it's particularly important because whereas you know when the state says to you, you know, you can't drive more than 55 miles an hour, and if you don't like it, you can lobby to get the law changed. The kind of controls that happen through technology for most people are completely invisible. Like, you know, you come to a place and it's gathering personal data about you. You don't know that it's gathering personal data about you. And even if you do know, you're not really necessarily aware of the fact that the technology could be made differently. It could be made to protect your privacy rather than invade your privacy. So it's a kind of regulator that we're particularly not well condition to think critically about, and that was the whole point of my first book, Code, which I'm right now, this weekend, finished the second version of that book, so it's a little bit interesting to have to go back to these issues 7 years later.
Now, I noticed on your website, lessig.org, for those interested in visiting it, where Larry holds a blog, too, that there is the second version of Code, Code V2. Is that going to come out in print, or is that simply going to be online?
Well, Code V2 started as a wiki, so we put up Code V1 and just had people add comments and changes to the wiki. And then I took that at the end of 2005, and I've been editing it since, sort of mm-hmm. rewriting it. And then that will come out as a book at the end of the year as Code V2. So the wiki will continue to live, but the sort of printed next version will be released, I think that's in December.
Our guest on Media Matters today, Larry Lessig, the Stanford Law Professor and author of many books, including Free Culture, The Future of Ideas and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you on this holiday weekend, April 16th, here on WILL AM 580. So please do call in with questions or comments for Professor Lessig. The number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Larry, the last time you were on the show, I think it was in the period leading up to the argument you would make before the U.S. Supreme Court on the Eldred case.
Yeah.
And it was a really terrific show, and we followed the case closely. You know, if you wouldn't mind, because, again, many of our listeners are not necessarily up to speed on constitutional cases, could you refresh our memories? What was the Eldred case about? What were you seeking to do? What was the outcome? And what's the importance of it?
Sure. So the Eldred case, you know, in its shortest form, is about a very familiar problem with government right now, which is the kind of corruption of the political process by special interests. So that plays out here with respect to the term of copyright. So the framers of our Constitution gave Congress the power to set a copyright term that was supposed to be, quote, limited. And for most of our history, it really was quite limited. The first term was 14 years renewable once. And until 1976, the term only was a maximum of term of 56 years, 28 years renewable once to 28 years. But beginning around 1962, Congress began to extend the term for existing copyrights. And in fact, 11 times between 1962 and 1998, Congress extended the term of existing copyrights. In 1998, they passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which extended the term of copyrights by another 20 years. Now, the extension of the term of copyright you might think of as making sense if you think the term is too short, because you might think you need a longer term to create more incentives for authors to create. Whether you believe that or not, the critical thing about that is the only way it's creating more incentives is if you're increasing the term in the future as opposed to the term in the past. So if you say, well, we need to create more incentives, so we'll from now on give people a longer term, that might produce more incentives. But the one thing we know is if you say, well, we're going to give people today a longer term in 1923, that's not going to change the amount of creativity in 1923 at all. The one thing Congress can't do is change the past. So whenever Congress extends the term of an existing copyright, it's not doing anything to create more incentives. All it's doing is just giving in to special interests who've been lobbying Congress so that they get a longer monopoly term and therefore get more rents. Well, in 1998, when they extended it by 20 years, that was the grossest, most extreme extension they'd ever done. We filed a lawsuit on behalf of Eric Eldred, who was someone who was posting public domain works to the Internet, and basically said, look, Congress is allowed to set, quote, limited terms. If every time Congress sets a term, it's allowed to extend it, then it's not in any meaningful sense a limited term. It's like telling your child he can have one cookie, and when you discover he's taken five, he replies, well, I just took one cookie, even though I took it five times in a row. Mm-hmm. That's basically what Congress is doing with copyright terms. So we basically said, look, conservatives on the Supreme Court, you say you're a bunch of originalists. Fine, look at the original meaning of the term limited times. Look what Congress was supposed to be doing in light of what the framers thought. And when you do that, you'll find all the reason in the world to strike this law down. Well, in fact, the five conservatives on the court who typically talk about originalism as the most important thing in constitutional interpretation basically were sleeping. None of the five conservatives wrote an opinion. So they voted on the side of upholding this extraordinary law. And then two justices who typically defer to Congress all the time, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Souter, also joined the majority. And then two justices, Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer, wrote very strong dissents in the case, saying this. Justice Breyer saying this made no economic sense at all because it's just increasing costs without getting any new creativity, and Justice Stevens saying this is not at all consistent with the tradition of intellectual property. So it was a depressing but illustrative case, depressing because we lost. But I think what it illustrated was that before we're going to get any real change in copyright or intellectual property regulation, we're going to have to work very hard to make this issue important or salient to a much wider group of people. You know, I was a typical kind of idealistic law professor who thought you could just march into the Supreme Court and get them to do what's right. And rarely does that happen. Maybe three times in our history has that ever happened. What you really have to do is you have to build recognition in the political system first so that it's easy for the court to do what's right. And that's basically what I've been doing ever since that case in 2002.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Professor Lawrence Lessig from the Stanford Law School, author of many books on the Internet, including Free Culture, The Future of Ideas, and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Professor Lessig, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Muhammad, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yes, hello. Larry, I've been following your work for over 10 years, I would say, and I'm very impressed with it, and I've learned a lot from you. But there's one thing that the Internet has caused a lot of change, more than just the patents and copyrights. As we know, freedom of the press is in trouble. There's open communication that the democracy is impacted. This thing goes so much deeper than just patents. And I frequently heard shows on WILL, Media Matters, and many other shows that talk about one aspect of this. A couple weeks ago, there was a program about bringing the Internet for free into people's homes at a very low cost, or basically free. But I don't hear anybody talking about the really big picture. About, I think, in order to get attention, people have to understand that it's not just about patents or copyrights or free wireless. It's a much, much deeper issue, because that comes with open communication like we've never had before, where peer-to-peer communication. So that's a comment I'd like to hear you comment on. It sounds like you've just briefly touched on that. And the other problem I have is that there's lots and lots of talk, including by you and people on the show, but what I don't see is real action. What we need is the Republicans and the conservatives got organized 10 or 20 years ago, and they really made a difference. Are we organizing and going to be able to do something about all of this and have real change occur? That's my question.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Larry, those are some big ones.
Yeah, they're big and extremely important. So first about the big issue. Well, you know, I go back and forth trying to figure out what the big issue here is. There's one big issue, which is how extraordinary these technologies will be to changing the way society functions. And you can think about any number of contexts in which that's going to be true. The most salient in the stuff I've been doing recently is just watching the way creativity changes. So watching the way kids use technology to create and share their creativity, whether it's blogs or just online material. Pew just did a study where 71% of teenagers had created and shared content on the internet. That's extraordinary in both its ability to empower people to be speakers and, you know, engage in a democratic process, and also just to be creators. And then that extends, obviously, to the democratic process, where the internet's going to be important much more to the bottom-up democracy and empowering that kind of bottom-up democracy. It's important to the press because, obviously, blogs have created a kind of discipline for the press, which at first they sneered about the influence of blogs, but now they can't help but respond to that. Obviously, also, it's going to change radically the way business can function. Much more competition, much more exciting development of products in the commercial side. So all of that, I think, would happen without, you know, kind of on its own if we just let the technology go, let things really take off the way they can. And so that might be one story. But the other story that, you know, is increasingly focusing my attention is the way in which these interests, special interests, who are threatened by these new ways that technology can be used, use the political process to stop it. So the telecom and cable companies are doing everything they can to gain the power to once again control what happens on the network. So this is the network neutrality debate, where the whole issue is whether the internet will be as it was designed, meaning anybody can send whatever packets through that they want without bias or favor by the network owner, or whether it's the network owner that gets to pick and choose what kind of content and what kind of applications run on the network. 2 years ago, I would have said it was about a 20% chance that we were going to see a internet where the network owners had that power. Right now, it's about a 90% chance, because essentially the FCC under the new chairman has lifted all regulations of telecom broadband providers, and they're trying to get a law passed which basically ratifies their power to do what they want on the internet. And the same story you can tell in the context of the, you know, content, intellectual property. That's, again, a story where special interests use their power in Congress to stop what otherwise would be this natural explosion of creativity. So you can tell this is a story about, you know, once again, the corruption of the political process by these special interests, or you could tell about a story about how it's going to remake society. Both of those are very big stories, and both of them, you know, are familiar. Now, about the second one, about actually doing something, well, you're right, we're not well organized enough, although I only knew this was Easter this weekend because I looked on my calendar and it was the one weekend I was not traveling this whole until June. I'm actually doing as much as I can to be out there to try to motivate and really create a movement around these issues. But we don't have a good political focus for these issues right now. That's partly because really the issues that are important to me cut across political lines. It's not like the Democrats are great about these issues or the Republicans are necessarily bad. So what's needed is a kind of political movement that's willing to be much more open to both sides of this debate, both sides of the political spectrum involved in this debate. And we're beginning to see that. There's an organization called IPAC, which is an IP Action Committee, that's raising funds and trying to educate Congress about these issues. Public Knowledge is something I'm on the board of in Washington that's trying to lobby around these issues. But we're just beginning, and the power on the other side is so extreme and so successful that it's hard to believe that these kind of Davids will be able to outgun that Goliath.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Larry Lessig. Before we go to our next caller, there's severe weather, as so many of our listeners are familiar with right now. And let me just make this announcement that a tornado watch is in effect for Christian, DeWitt, Douglas, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby counties. And a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties. Will Severe Weather Coverage Area says that this severe weather storm watch is in effect till 7 o'clock this evening. Stay tuned. We'll keep updating you every 15 minutes or so on this weather. Larry, you're an old Midwesterner, aren't you?
I grew up in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought you were from Wisconsin or something. I don't know where I got that. Well, yeah, you're not familiar with the weather we get here. Believe me, it's insanity.
Yeah.
It's like having your computer crash on you.
I can imagine, yeah.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. If you would like to call in with a question or comment for Larry Lessig, the phone number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. If you want to go online and learn more about Professor Lessig's work and see his blog, go to Lessig, LESSIG.org, and you'll find everything you need. Line 2, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Hi. Calling in, I wanted to get your comments on the digital rights media thing. Happened, I believe it was Suncom and XVT that were on CDs. I remember being extraordinarily irate when I found out about the potential that had to both destabilize the security of computer systems and then also the potential to just crash things in the future. And I was wondering both your thoughts on that and if you had information on sort of what the legal ramifications of that have been for the companies involved.
Sure.
Maybe you could give a little background for listeners unfamiliar with digital rights management, Larry.
Sure. So the most recent battle around this was triggered by a decision that Sony BMG made to embed in their CDs technology to control how you actually could use the CDs, how many times you could copy the songs, or whether you could move the songs across to different devices. And to do that, it modified the rootkit on the Windows operating system, or it was a rootkit that modified the core sort of operating system functionality, and basically installed software on your computer to control how you used your computer with respect to those CDs. Now, it was extremely poorly written software, so what it also did was open up a whole bunch of security holes for especially computers that were on business networks that had virus-protecting software or other security software on the computer. And for many people who weren't on those, it just basically degraded the functionality of the computer. And so people were outraged, rightfully so, and demanded that Sony do something to correct this. And a number of organizations, including one of which I'm a board member, EFF, brought lawsuits against Sony, basically charging them with spreading computer viruses, knowingly, intentionally spreading computer viruses that created harm to people's computer systems, and Sony very quickly settled that lawsuit. So this is a battle, and some people think a victory, because what happened was that this deployment of technology was resisted by consumers, and Sony basically very quickly backed down. But one thing that's interesting about that is this is a DRM attached to CDs. But DRM attached to digital music, for example, the DRM that restricts what you can do with an Apple iTunes song, for example, if you want to buy a song from iTunes, you can't play it on an MP3 player except for the iPod. That type of DRM is it basically the same kind of functionality that the Sony BMG was. It was controlling what you could do with songs that you otherwise had bought. But there hasn't been any similar kind of consumer reaction or very strong consumer reaction against that kind of control. And that difference is something that really puzzles me, because if you're opposed to Sony's control for reasons other than just the fact that they did it so poorly, then why is there no similar resistance to the Apple control, or at least the resistance to certain kinds of Apple control, like why you can't play the Apple's music on anything other than Apple iPod? And so I think that there's a little bit more education that has to happen before there's really strong consumer reaction to the widespread DRM that's out there right now.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Larry Lessig, the Stanford Law Professor. My name's Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters here on April 16th, 2006 on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Lessig, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. In the next few weeks here on Media Matters, our guests will include the historian Howard Zinn, Janine Jackson from the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and in a few weeks, a much-anticipated guest, the author Walter Mosley. So stay tuned to Media Matters. We've got some great shows coming up. Thanks to our producer, Andrew Boyle, who's hard at work constantly tracking down the best possible guest. Larry, following up on this issue with musicians, one of the big Supreme Court cases the year after Eldred, this past spring, was the Grokster case. And this was a case that a lot of people in the music industry paid very careful attention to. And you've written about it, I know, on your blog. Could you give a little background on what the issues were in the Grokster Place case, how it was decided, and, you know, what your interpretation of it is?
Sure. So Grokster was the latest litigation around peer-to-peer technologies. And Grokster and a couple other related companies had a particularly effective peer-to-peer technology that many people were using to share music in a way which the courts have held to be illegal. So the question was whether the music companies or the copyright holders could not only hold the people who are downloading music illegally responsible for their wrongful acts, but also hold the company itself that produced the software or facilitated the network of peer-to-peer technologies, whether they could be held responsible for the illegal use of the technology, too. Now, you know, it's important first to recognize that this is a pretty general question, right? So should we hold Smith & Wesson responsible for the people who are killed with their guns? Or should we hold car manufacturers responsible for the people who are killed with by third parties who are killed by cars that improperly used? Now, and in the context at least of guns, of course, there's such a very strong reaction against the idea of ever holding the manufacturer responsible that Congress has even passed laws explicitly saying you can't hold the manufacturer responsible. But here in the context of copyright technology, the question whether you hold the manufacturer responsible for technology used to violate someone's copyright was originally decided in the Supreme Court in a very famous case called the Sony Betamax case. 1976, when the Sony Betamax was first released, Universal filed a lawsuit against Sony, saying that Sony ought to be held responsible for the copyright infringements that are committed using this VCR technology, Betamax technology, because the Betamax was designed to make it so you could record shows off of television. Many of those shows would be copyrighted. Many of the copyright owners would not want people to be recording their shows. So it's a technology designed to make it possible for people to violate copyright. And it took about 8 years, and the Supreme Court finally decided the case in 1984. And what the Supreme Court decided in 1984 was that if you produce a technology which is, quote, capable of substantial non-infringing uses, end quote, then the producer of the technology is not responsible for the copyright violations using the technology. Instead, any liability is just a liability you have to bring against the particular person violating the law. That standard was extraordinarily important to launch the consumer electronics industry, because basically it meant that the only technologies that would be responsible or illegal under this standard would be those that are solely used to violate copyright, not those that can be used for many purposes, some of which might be to violate copyright. And under that principle, many of us thought that peer-to-peer technologies, too, should be free of any legal liability, because while many people use it to do illegal things, like copy songs they shouldn't copy, many people also use it to facilitate very cheap distribution of large files for perfectly legitimate reasons. I use peer-to-peer technology all the time to make my lectures available or to make videos that I've made about particular political issues available. And the cost of distributing using peer-to-peer is about 0.1% of the cost of distributing in the traditional way. So it's a very important technology for facilitating free speech. But the Supreme Court looked at it, and because they didn't like, there wasn't a sexy company like Sony on the other side this time, there was instead people who weren't as respectable in the eyes of the court, I think. The court, though they said they were keeping the standard, really very significantly changed the standard of Sony. The court basically said, if you if you develop a product and intend to induce people to violate copyright by developing that product, then you can be held responsible for the violations of copyright. Now, as a theoretical matter or an academic matter, that doesn't sound like a terrible thing, because how many people will really just be intending to facilitate copyright? But as a practical matter, this is an extraordinarily destructive decision for innovation, because what this means is anytime the copyright owner wants to threaten a new technology, they've just got to file a lawsuit and say, well, let's figure out what you intended. So show me all your emails, show me all your letters, show me all your conversations with your product managers, so I can see whether you just intended to use this product as a way to induce copyright infringement. And because they can threaten that, basically innovators know that they can't innovate in ways copyright owners don't like, and so innovation will be significantly colored or changed because of the threat of this potential liability. And the record companies have, you know, taken this decision, and they've gone out and they've been quite aggressive in telling technology companies they have to change the way they're developing technologies, or else they will face this kind of Grokster liability. And unfortunately, it's imposing a pretty significant chill on innovation throughout our part of the country out here in Silicon Valley.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Professor Lawrence Lessig, a Stanford University law professor and one of the leading writers and authorities on the Internet and on policies, especially constitutional legal policies, but all policies pertaining to the Internet and its development. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Lessig, the number here at WILL is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I want to return to the weather warning before we get back to our program, Professor Lessig, that a tornado watch is in effect for Christian, DeWitt, Douglas, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby counties, and a severe weather storm watch is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties until 7 o'clock tonight. So everyone, please, if you're in those counties, make the necessary preparations. I'm getting another – my producer's handing me yet another update right now. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Logan County in central Illinois and northern Sangamon County in central Illinois. So if you're in either Logan or northern Sangamon County, it is not time to be hanging out in the backyard, but take precautions, because this is a very serious business proceeding toward you. Larry Lessig, one of the things you've just been touching on with discussion of Grokster is how regulations can impede innovation. And it's one of the themes I think your work has always touched upon, how this is, in addition to being a free speech issue and an issue about ideas, it's also about economic development. And one of the great developments, or not great, but notable developments in the last several years, is how the United States has really fallen way behind many other countries in the world in the percentage of the population that has access to broadband. How important is this, and what can be done to change that?
This is an extremely important issue, and it's one of the least reported issues. And it's astonishing that nobody pays attention to it. August 5th, 2005 was maybe the most important day in the history of the decline of the Internet. Because on August 5th, 2005, the FCC decided finally that no broadband provider, whether telecom or cable, was under any regulatory obligations at all to maintain neutrality on their network. Now, neutrality in communications network had been a central part of regulatory policy since at least 1968, when the FCC began to enforce a very strong principle of neutrality, meaning that you could attach whatever device to the telecommunications network you wanted as long as it didn't harm the network, and the network couldn't take steps to discriminate against you just because you were attaching some device that they might rather want to sell their own services to provide it to you. So, for example, you know, with the old telephone system, you were allowed to attach your own answering machine. And the fact that AT&T had their sort of voicemail system didn't give AT&T the power or the right to come in and say, well, we're going to give you less quality service or we're going to charge you more because you're not using our voicemail service. So this principle of neutrality has been at the core of communications. And now that it's been removed, what the broadband providers are talking about is basically picking and choosing the kind of applications that get preferential treatment or the kind of content that gets preferential treatment on the Internet. And they'll pick and choose according to which types of applications benefit them and which benefit their particular business model. So one of the most important new network applications is voice over IP, which radically lowers the cost of voice communication services. And the quality of this, voice over IP, is increasing dramatically. So this could be a really important way to lower the cost of telephone service. Well, now that the broadband providers are allowed to pick and choose, they can begin to say that, well, the only voice over IP service we're going to allow on our broadband network is this one that we've bundled for $25 or $35 into our service, and you're not allowed to use anybody else's voice over IP service. That fundamentally changes the way the Internet has functioned. What it does is radically reduce competition for applications and services on the Internet, and it will increase the cost of applications and services on the Internet. And it's all of this change is being produced by this very simplistic ideology that is reigns inside the FCC right now, which is the government has got to step out of the way and can't be any regulation of any of this communication services at all. Well, you know, that's just a complete reversal on the way in which telecommunications has been provided. And it's exactly the countries that have followed the traditional model for regulating telecommunications, like France and Japan and Korea, that have actually produced the most vigorous, most impressive broadband penetration of anywhere in the world. So the idea that France has better broadband provided to its citizens at like 1/11th the price of broadband in the United States should be an embarrassment to policymakers in Washington. And yet they don't even notice it. They don't even pay it. They don't even acknowledge the fact that their policies have led us to being either 13th or 19th, depending on the index that you look at, in broadband penetration in the world, when everybody should have expected that we would be number one in this deployment of this important technology for economic growth.
I hear periodically from people I know in the computer industry and working in Internet-related areas that innovation is increasingly leaving the United States, that the cutting edge is no longer in Silicon Valley or Redmond or wherever it was in the United States, Silicon Alley in Manhattan, but is increasingly in Europe or Asia. Is that your sense as well?
It certainly is, because, you know, countries like Japan are talking about providing gigabit per second broadband service to consumers. Now, gigabit sounds a little bit obscure, but here in San Francisco, you're lucky if you can get 1.5 megabits. So a gigabit is 1,000 megabits.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what we're talking about is radically better broadband service. And as innovators need better broadband service, they'll begin to innovate for countries where that service exists. Now, you know, I was on the phone with one of the leaders of one of these telecom companies talking about what their intended policy for the United States was. And they were talking about how they fundamentally needed to control what happened on the network. That's the only way it could be worth it for them to provide 6, maybe 8 megabits a second. And I'm thinking, you know, if this is what we're arguing about, then this is really terrifying, because 8 or 10 megabits per second is nothing. What we ought to be providing and developing inside the United States is what the rest of the world is developing. We ought to be developing services that are almost, 50 to 100 to 1,000 times faster than that. Because with a gigabits per second, you can basically get your television service, your telephone service, your computer service, all across the same line at an extremely low cost. Much more innovation and development in the use of the internet service than is possible with the kind of pathetic broadband service that we have right now. So we are falling behind. Our policymakers are adopting policies that will mean we fall further behind. And all these policies do is simply benefit a few very powerful companies that happen to have the most powerful set of lobbyists in Washington. I think the most powerful lobbyists are Hollywood's, and the second most powerful are the telecom and cable industry. And they're getting the benefits from their very powerful lobbies.
And it's worth noting that the industries that dominate internet service provision that provide broadband, such as it is in the United States, the telephone and cable industries, are both established entirely on the basis of having received government monopoly licenses. Their entire business has been built on this. So they're not free enterprise industries that were duking it out in their garages.
Absolutely.
At any stage in their history, they're purely government-created entities. Our guest today on Media Matters, Larry Lessig, Stanford Law Professor, one of the great authorities on the internet and the issues surrounding it today. You can learn more about Larry Lessig by going to his website, Lessig, L-E-S-S-I-G, Lessig.org. And you can learn more by calling in and asking him a question here at Media Matters, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Before we go to our next caller, we've got someone very patient. I do want to follow up on what you've been talking about, Larry Lessig. One of the movements that's taken place in the last couple of years in the United States, and it's very strong here in Champaign-Urbana, is for community wireless systems to sort of bypass the big phone and cable companies and set up a wireless system that makes it virtually ubiquitous in a community to get high-quality broadband service. Are you very familiar with this process, and what's your sense of their importance?
I think it's extremely important. It's one of the only hopeful developments that I think might break the monopoly power of the telecom and cable companies. And that's because the potential, technological potential of these wireless services is so much greater than anybody really expects. One of my heroes in wireless policy is a guy named Duane Hendricks, who runs a company called Dandrin out here that provides wireless service development for communities and for private organizations. But they're developing a wireless service for a Native American reservation in Arizona that's about 1,300 square miles. Now, this 1,300 square mile reservation is going to have broadband service, which is 100 megabits symmetric, which means you can send things up the internet and receive things down the internet at the same speed, and the speed is, again, just about 70 times faster than what you can get in San Francisco. And they're going to provide this service much more cheaply than you can get the service wired to you given existing broadband business models. And I think that when you've got a bunch of communities that are demonstrating the power of this kind of broadband offer in the same way that we offer other public, utilities like streetlights or like public roads, then I think the push for communities to support this will be much, much greater. And there's a kind of weird reverse racism that goes on here. I think that if Native American reservations have 100 megabit wireless internet service, that's the best way to guarantee that we get it in the rest of the country, because there's no way that congressmen from Virginia or from New York are going to stand for the idea that that you get better internet service on Native American reservations than you do in their hometown. So this is an extremely important development, and I think that you're going to see a lot of communities deploying it in a way that begins to make the claims of the cable and telecom companies that it should cost $70 a month to get 1 megabit per second internet seemed just like the joke that it really is.
And, of course, I think you are familiar with one of the big political fights around community internet being the effort of the cable and telephone companies to make it illegal for communities to set up competing internet services, so to kill it in the crib before people have an opportunity to see what it's like.
Yeah, this is, again, it's the same story that we were talking about at the beginning about how, they use political power to stop competition that doesn't, that threatens them. And so I think, I don't remember the number of states that exist right now. It's something like 23 or 24 states have passed laws to forbid municipalities from providing this kind of service, as a solely to protect the power of the telecom and cable companies. So the latest recent battle about this happened in Pennsylvania, where Philadelphia, you know, basically turned to the cable and telephone companies and said, "Look, you guys don't even sell broadband service in the poor neighborhoods of our city, and we're just not going to accept the idea that poor Philadelphians will not be part of the internet generation because you choose not to sell services there. So we're going to provide free. We're going to provide a wireless service for citywide." And when Philadelphia said that they were going to do that, the cable companies and the telephone companies went to the state government and got them to pass a law to block municipalities from doing it. And the only compromise was that they exempted Philadelphia from that law. So nowhere else in Pennsylvania are you allowed to get the benefit of broadband provided the way Philadelphia does. But at least in Philadelphia, they've now deployed this service to give broadband access all across the city. San Francisco is doing similar things. There are many cities that are doing this around the country. And I think we really have to encourage people to do this because, again, you can talk about theory all you want. You can talk about what's possible in theoretical terms economically. But it's only when you actually build it. You can take people there and you can say, see, it's possible to have wireless service that's robust and cheap. And why doesn't your city have it, too, that we get the political movement to spread this beyond the few lucky cities that have it right now.
For listeners interested in this subject, the freepress.net website has a pretty comprehensive coverage of what communities do have community wireless service now, and also a political map of the states where there are laws in place. And Larry, good news is that in virtually most of the states that have tried to pass these laws, they've been shut down by popular opposition when people have been alerted to what was going on. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Robert from San Francisco, you've been very patient. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Good morning, Dr. Lessig. Thank you very much. I know that your work has impacted very favorably in my life over the last few years. I just was calling to say that recently Matthew Stannard of the San Francisco Chronicle, echoing Orville Schell, dean of the Berkeley School of Journalism, recently wrote that journalism's current crisis has less to do with the conduct of the Iraq War and more to do with its timing, smack in the middle of the biggest technological revolution journalism has seen in years. As I see it, they are blaming the Internet for failures in the mainstream media. Anyway, my question is, what is your opinion about the power of the Internet vis-a-vis the mainstream media, particularly how would you grade the mainstream media's coverage of issues relating to technology and the Internet?
Thank you.
Well, I'm, you know, a professor, and I grade people regularly, but usually very forgivingly. In this context, I wouldn't be forgiving at all. I think their grade is extremely low. And the reason for this is actually related, I think, largely to a lot of the issues that Bob has been working on for a long time. Concentration in media. So as media becomes more concentrated and news departments become just another part of a profit-making business, they become much more timid in what they can cover and how they can cover these issues. And so this pressure, this commercial pressure, as it's been allowed to develop, actually weakens the competitive, in the traditional journalistic sense, intuitions of journalists. I mean, I've been doing a lot of consulting recently in the context of documentary filmmakers who are trying to make films to document, you know, obviously the important political issues that are going on. A bunch of them have been making films that have, you know, tried to use clips from the 2000 election and coverage of the 2000 election. Uniformly, the networks will refuse to license those clips. And so, you know, the decision's always got to be about whether using them without permission is fair use, which is a very complicated judgment. But in one of the recent examples of this, the film producer was friends with a person licensing or giving permissions at one of these networks. And when permission was denied, she said to the friend of hers at this network, "So why is this? Like, why can't we get access to this?" And quite unselfconsciously, this agent for one of these major networks said, you have to understand, if we give you permission to use this, we will lose access in Washington to major political figures." So it's a system of using the incentives of both the competitive market incentives and also just the power that the government has in this context to silence a certain kind of journalism, a certain kind of critical journalism. And that's what makes so important what I think of as the amateur journalists. And I mean amateur not in the sense that they're second rate, but in the sense that they do what they do for the love of what they do and not for the money. It makes amateur journalists so important because we need speakers out there who are not afraid of the consequences, economic consequences or political consequences, of what they say, so they can just say things that are true. Now, a lot of them will say things that are ridiculous, and that's fine, but we need more people who have the abilities, both the capacity and also the economic ability to say things that they just want to say what's true and not what will get them the best advertising or the best access to the White House. And I think that's a really terrifying feature of where the current debate around journalism is right now.
Our guest today, Larry Lessig. We have time for one more caller. Hopefully it'll be brief. Line 1, Indiana, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I had a couple quick questions. There's sort of one question. One is, things like Linux are kind of a wild card where there isn't a lot of copyright involved. And then the other question I had was, what about the Europeans? Because they seem like they're taking a fairly aggressive set of actions against Microsoft, for instance, over a period of time in trying to break some of the monopolistic nature of the business that's arisen maybe from this copyright issue. But if you could just comment on some of these other things that could come in to open things up.
Larry, we've only got about 40 seconds left, so you can just pick what you want to talk about.
Sure. So the GNU Linux operating system is extremely important in increasing competition in the market for operating systems. And I think both the Europeans' actions against Microsoft and Linux is an extremely important reason why we have more competition in operating systems. But that's really separate from a lot of the battle that's happening over content and the concentration of the content market. And we don't yet have the GNU Linux that is liberating us in that space.
Larry Lessig, we've only got a few seconds left. What's your media diet look like? Where do you go every day to sort of stay on top of these issues?
Probably about 70% blogs and about 30% just reading, the sort of collection of news through like Google News or through New York Times.
And if people go to your website, lessig.org, will they find links to some of these blogs?
Yes.
Okay, Larry Lessig, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today in Media Matters. It's been a delight having you. Good luck with your work out there at Stanford and with the Center for Internet and Society and with the new book, Code V2, coming out, I guess, fairly soon. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for listening to Media Matters this week. I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle, our technical director, Brett Polson, and I'll be back in 167 hours with Howard Zinn. Thank you all, listeners. Bye-bye.